My name is Dustin Washington, and I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight to share what promises to be a very powerful event. I'm from the People's Coalition for Justice, and we're a grassroots collective of anti-racist organizers that are currently focusing on police brutality and racial profiling. We put this event together tonight because we saw that there was a disconnect between the work that was done, the organizing work that was done in this city before us, and the activism that's going on right now. And we feel that it's very powerful that and very important that we do something like what we're doing tonight to bridge the gulf that lies between us. There's so much for us to learn from the people sitting up here. And I know Cindy didn't want to be called an elder now, but That's a term of respect from us. We believe if we don't know where we've been, we sure as hell ain't going to know where we're going. And these are the true leaders in this city, not the fools that we have downtown who've been selling out to people. These are the true leaders, and this is who we need to learn from. So I ask everyone to please enjoy tonight. Peace.
Hi, everybody. My name is Soya Jung. I'm on the steering committee of the People's Coalition for Justice, and it's my honor to introduce tonight's speakers. Before I do that, I just want to mention to everybody that there is a sign-up sheet that's going to be passed around the room. So when it comes by, please make sure to sign up and let us know how to get in touch with you so we can tell you about more events in the future. So the first speaker tonight is Tyree Scott. Tyree has been involved in the effort to force the construction industry and the building trade unions to racially integrate their workforces. In a protest against the Washington State Highway Department not adhering to affirmative action hiring procedures, Tyree once broke into the I-90 bridge and opened the draw span to halt traffic. He has organized protests, demonstrations, marches. He's gotten arrested and gone on hunger strikes for the purpose of making the racial integration of the working class apparent to all. So it's my honor to introduce Tyree Scott.
Thank you. Well, as most of you can see, it's a long time since I've been on a hunger strike, huh? I got my Juan Jose Bocanegra on tonight. Well, I'm really pleased to be here, and I really am an old guy. But I wouldn't want to get called over until they put me in the same category with Cindy, and then I felt like, yes. There are three of us who are going to talk to you tonight, so I think it's important, rather than when they asked me, you know, what should we say about you, I thought about that story about the bridge, because I thought only about young people coming here tonight, and I thought, well, let's tell them some story about some adventurous stuff, and then they'll show up and we'll talk about it, those kinds of things. But that kind of, I guess there's a context for that kind of adventurism, but that's not the heart and soul of what our work is about, and I'll try to talk more about that. But I said there's three of us talking, and I think it's important that we understand the context in which all of us are talking in, the context of the struggle itself, so that even though at times we've been doing things at different places, the context in which this struggle is taking place is in the context of the great class struggle, the struggle between those who own all the means and the struggle for those who produce everything in the world. Now, that's the struggle I think that the context in which we've been involved in this struggle. So that this struggle began with me, because I'm older than both Cindy and Aaron. And of course it didn't. Nor did it begin with my parents or with their parents. But the nature of the struggle is a protracted one. And so that it goes on before us and it'll go on after us. And we're but a part in a period. And so that's why I think it's important that we look at it in this context, because your time has come. And you're a continuation of the struggle that we've been engaged in or that we inherited. And it's not the same because some things have changed. I mean, but it's the same struggle. So even though things have changed in the context of it. So I'm gonna talk about, first I'll just tell you a little bit about my own personal history and about the movement that I'm identified most with. But I'd like to say that I want to be identified most with the class struggle as opposed to the struggle for racial equality. Because the struggle for racial equality is in the context of the class struggle. Because the other night I heard I don't know if anybody in here went to the camp dinner, because they cost $65 a head to come in there, and y'all don't look like a $65 a head crowd. But the guest speaker was this guy named Arthur Fletcher. He's about 15 years older than me, and he reinvented a whole lot of things that, you know, while he was talking. And he was billed as the father of affirmative action. Now, he was appointed by Richard Nixon as an assistant secretary of labor. And so you can imagine, and he's a Republican, so you can imagine then who he was. But I think one point he made, which I want to talk to you guys about, but he said that his father was a Buffalo soldier. Now, he was bragging about that. Now, most of you in the room at least have heard of the Buffalo soldiers. They were these black cavalrymen who the Indians dubbed Buffalo soldiers because they couldn't tell where the horse stopped and the man began, because they were both the same color and all this. And so they got called the Buffalo soldiers. But what was the task of the Buffalo soldiers? That's what we have to look at. These men, fresh up from slavery, their task was to kill Indian people. So now, if you don't understand the context in which you're working, then you can confuse yourself and think that those guys were good guys. So he was bragging that his father was a Buffalo soldier. It's like saying my father was a pimp. But he didn't get that though. He meant it as something that he should be proud of, and we should all be proud of the fact that he was a continuation, and he was. He's a modern day Buffalo soldier, riding to the rescue. But anyway, I'll start there. In 1965, I was a Buffalo soldier. I was a Marine and I went off to Vietnam. And luckily, I made it back home this following year. But I came home with another attitude about the world. I didn't understand the world, but I didn't think what I was doing was proper. And after 9 years, I got out of the Marine Corps. And 10 years later, when that war ended, 1975, I was also in the streets celebrating the victory of the Vietnamese people. So I made a transition from being a Buffalo soldier to being somebody who opposed U.S. imperialism. I hadn't yet understood the class struggle, but I was moving towards trying to understand that as well. But it wasn't me. And I don't want to put this in the context of myself as an individual, but I lived in a particular time. And it was a time when people had realized that it was time to change, or some things had to change. But I want to talk a little bit about why does the change take place, and what's the possibilities of that change going one way or the other. And I think that's what is important, that we need to recognize that although we don't make the times, we don't invite the people out into the streets and say, look, we've been screwed over with long enough, it's time for us to go out and make a change. That doesn't happen. What does happen is a situation any of us might not have any idea why this is going to happen or when it's going to happen. But when it happens, people go out into the streets en masse. because they're fed up with the situation and the conditions that exist. But we can't just sit around and wait for that to happen, though, because if we do, we don't know which way they're going to go. People oftentimes, if you listen to the propaganda, we blame our friends sometimes because we don't recognize who the enemy is. Again, we might consider Buffalo Soldiers heroes if we don't really try to figure that out. And so I'm talking about the two different times. When at one time, there's a period when everything takes off. Other times, there's a period when almost nothing is happening that we can see anyway. So Cindy's going to talk about her brother, Selmy Domingo, who was a very good friend of a lot of us who are active nowadays. But I want to just say a little bit about something Selmy used to always say to us. He always talked about this idea, and he didn't originate with him, but he always talked about it, the idea of the ebb and the flow. And so I was talking earlier that I think that I was lucky enough to live in a period when there was a great flow. But that I'm also living in a period when there's an ebb, when it doesn't look like much is going on. We elected Ronald Reagan, and for 12 years, not much went on, we think. But that period is a period where we have to work our hardest. Because in that period, we gather the leadership for the next flow. And in the absence of gathering that leadership, people don't recognize who the enemy is, and we blame the problem on welfare mothers. We blame the problem on the unemployed or on somebody of color, because we haven't figured out that it's the multinational corporations, or it's the people who hold the capital who are causing the problem. And so during that period of the ebb is when we try and educate and develop new leadership, or develop our own leadership, or develop reputation for our organizations and for doing the exemplary work. And so I think that if we hear the speeches tonight and listen to the context of what people, the context which we're talking, is that that's what had to go on. That we engaged in a period of flow when the people were ready to go out into the streets and demand change. And during the periods of ebb, we need to work to build organization and to educate the new leadership for the next period of the flow. I mean, in my lifetime, not your lifetime, but in Germany, there was a flow, and look who the leadership was. The National Socialists ended up the leadership. Which what we all decided today was really bad ideas. But 20 years before that, in the Soviet Union or in Russia, there was a flow. And the Bolshevik Party ended up the leadership, which we think had some better ideas at that time anyway. And they took the power. There was a flow in South Africa most recently, in the early 90s. And the ANC took the power. Now, it doesn't always mean that things didn't go right from that point on. We're not here to talk, I guess we're not to talk about that, but I just want to kind of keep the context in that so we can understand that people in this room, many of your young men came tonight talked about they were a part of a collective. But so I want to just talk a little bit about organization, that after 1968-69, we started to build organization, and we used the Black construction workers because we knew that we were interested in trying to better our conditions. We didn't see the whole struggle, but we saw that we needed to have an organization to do this. So we built an organization called the United Construction Workers Association. It was a narrow organization because we were trying to address the problems of racial discrimination in the building trades. But it wasn't long before we realized that we needed to unite with broader groups and try to build something even broader. And then eventually, we ended up building LELO, which is an organization that now I'm a part of, that Cindy's also a part of, that's made up of workers from the Asian community, from the Latino community, both men and women, as well as drag workers. And we've got a worldview. But I just want to talk just now just about why we think this question of organization is important and why this group here. Because how many of you in here belong to a student organization? Not very many. But 20 years ago, had I asked that question, there would have been the young students from the Black Student Union. There would have been students from the MESHA, the Mexican American Student Unions. There would have been the Asian Student Union. All these organizations would have existed on the campus, and they created a situation for change on the campuses. There were no, the only programs were the Eurocentric programs that taught about Columbus discovering America. But those student organizations created change. And so now, organizations don't exist. But let me just say what these organizations can do. And I'm going to sit on this Cindy talking and Aaron talking, and we can deal with this in the question and answer period. But those are, I mean, as an organization, we're able to extend ourselves as individuals. Because I've got certain strengths and I've got certain weaknesses. My organization maximizes my strengths and it minimizes my weaknesses. So I don't get assigned to do work that I'm not good at, but I get assigned to do work that I'm good at. And so the organization does good work in this area. And other ideas that I might have that I can't say, I should say that I can't write. But somebody else might write down those ideas that might have come out of my head. But I got extended as a person in the context of an organization. So organizations extend individuals. And in the hands of working people, organizations become tools. It's our only tool, as a matter of fact. So it's a trade union. Trade unions, for example, is a major tool for working people. You know, they only deal with, in our country, with the question of economics, but they do just that. Well, were they not organized, they wouldn't even get that accomplished. And so, if I had a message to bring to you tonight, I could talk to you about, you know, how we closed the bridge down and have you laughing about, you know, how stupid the bosses were and couldn't catch up with us. But the message I would want to bring to you would be that you need to organize, that you need to belong to an organization, and you need not stay in the same one for 30 or 40 years, because you either sharpen the organization or you move on and build other organizations. But individuals have a very difficult time extending themselves, because you can't make all the meetings and you can't do all the issues. So I would say that if my work has meant anything, is that I've been a part of a process that's built a workers' organization in this city that's independent and free of the influence from downtown on the one hand, and has a very broad view of the world, so that we don't think that there's going to be a separate piece for Black construction workers in the absence of freeing Leonard Peltier, for example. We don't think that men are going to be able to go forward and have the little ladies stay home. We got some idea about the question of gender discrimination. But these ideas came from, you know, from in the course of struggle. Women in our organization forced the men forward. Were we not organized, that wouldn't have happened. So I want to end by saying that I think that if this group gets anything from this discussion tonight, that it needs to look at this question of the lack of organization amongst young people, amongst the student body, that you organize, you can push the process forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. The next speaker we have is Cindy Domingo. And Cindy is, as Tyree mentioned, her brother, Silmi Domingo, and his friend, Gene Vernis, were both Filipino Cantor Union organizers and racial justice activists. and they were both killed in a planned murder by Philippine dictator Ferdinand Marcos. Cindy led a 10-year national campaign to win justice for them, the two of them, and in the end her work paid off because for the first time a U.S. court found that a foreign government was responsible for the assassination of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil. So please welcome, it's my great honor to introduce Cindy Domingo.
You know, after 26 years of activism, you'd think that speaking before people gets easier and easier, but it doesn't. I still get pretty nervous when I have to do public speaking, and oftentimes I think maybe I should just go into retirement since now I'm an elder. So I told that to K.L. Shannon. But, you know, as people say, it's, you know, in the movement, it's your responsibility to share your experiences and to learn from each other, and that's what I'm hoping that we'll do tonight is to learn from each other. On the one hand, you know, Dustin said there, he feels that there's a gap between our generation and the younger generation, and I guess, you know, when all of us were becoming activists, we had no older generation to look to. Because of the McCarthy era, there was a whole generation of people that were taken out of activism. And so when we decided to take up to become activists, we had no one to turn to. So I think our generation is here to share our experiences and to continue building a movement here in the United States around, as Tyree said, around the class struggle. It's always a pleasure to follow Tyree because he always presents the broad framework in which I think all three of us take up our work, in which all three of us became activists. It was to take up the class struggle. And that's what keeps us going today. I want to add, you know, in terms of, even though Aaron and Tyree are a tad bit older than I am, the three of us actually, you know, during the 60s and 70s became activists in a very exciting period. And I think, you know, as Tyree said, we were all very fortunate in some ways to develop as activists during that period of time. And when people talk about the 60s and 70s and laugh at us because they said they thought, our generation thought that the revolution was right around the corner, it really was for us. If you look back in history and see what was happening around the world, revolution was occurring all over the world. If you look at the struggles in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America, there was revolution going on. The national liberation struggles and the peoples in those national liberation struggles were overturning governments, overturning dictatorships all over the world. And it was in that period of time that the three of us and many other thousands of activists and don't think that the left was only white in this country. It was people of color like us, Asian Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans. All of us were becoming activists at that period of time, along with white activists. And it was because of the inspiration that we derived from those national liberation struggles that we felt that there was an urgency to take up solidarity work during that period of time. Because of those movements, we drew our inspiration from those movements. And we learned from their experiences. Many activists from those national liberation struggles came here to the United States in exile for fear of their lives because they were tortured, because their families were being tortured. They were faced with murder. They came here and helped develop movements here in this country. And, you know, a lot of people now are afraid to talk about Marxism-Leninism and Maoism. And those were the ideologies in which we very seriously studied in study circles and proudly carried the names that we were Marxist-Leninists. And at times we said we were Maoists, but since then we've rejected Maoism. So some of us have. I don't know about others. but it was a very exciting period in which also these activists formed revolutionary organizations. I myself was a member of the Union of Democratic Filipinos, the KDP. That's the acronym for the Tagalog version of the Union of Democratic Filipinos. I became active as a result of my first trip to the Philippines in 1974. I'm an American-born Filipino. I'd never been to the Philippines until 1974. And that was 2 years into martial law in the Philippines. And for someone who comes from the United States, knowing very little about their history, knowing very little about a dictatorship, knowing very little about a country in which the majority of the population lives in poverty, it was a turning point in my life. And fortunately for me, after I came back, the Union of Democratic Filipinos was beginning to form a chapter here in Seattle. My brother, Salmi Domingo, which Tyree had mentioned, was at the center of forming that chapter. And I attended my first demonstration on September 22nd, 1974, which was the second anniversary of the declaration of martial law. And that's how I, that's where I marked my period of activism, and it was 25 years last year. And as a result of becoming active in the Union of Democratic Filipinos, I quickly became involved in the struggle to restore democracy in the Philippines, which took me from 1974 to 1989, even though democracy was restored in the Philippines in 1986. 1989 was when we finally won my brother's case. And at the period of time, also when the Union of Democratic Filipinos was forming in Seattle, we were, the members of the KDP were also involved in a number of different struggles throughout the city, including the effort to save the International District as a neighborhood. Many of the students that were at the center of the KDP were also students at the University of Washington in the midst of their identity crisis, in the midst of searching for their identity, I mean. And then also were very active in terms of saving the International District from the destruction of the building of the Dome Stadium that was blown up last year. And, you know, it's ironic to see the stadiums now, because when we were fighting the Dome Stadium, we didn't. They said they needed a dome stadium to protect the teams. Now they want a stadium that doesn't have a dome. And, you know, it's just it's crazy. Anyway, so in there was a convergence not only then of the struggles that were going on internationally, but the domestic struggles that were happening in the Seattle community. And the wonderful thing about the movement in Seattle is that it has a deep history of the various racial groups working together, the revolutionary organizations that formed at that period of time. So in the effort to save the International District, it was always commonplace to find the black construction workers with us, the Black Panther parties, the Latinos from El Centro de la Raza, the Native Americans who were fighting for fishing rights, coming down to the International District demonstrating. And you would find the same thing out at Frank's Landing when they were fighting for fishing rights. You would find the same thing out in Rainier Valley when the construction workers wanted black construction workers wanted access to the jobs. It was a very multiracial group. And so, you know, it's a history that a lot of other cities don't have. And while we find each other now, those that were together at that period of time may find themselves on different sides of the fence now. It's a great history to learn from in terms of coalition building and how people's issues have a commonality amongst the various racial groups. I'm going to kind of fast forward to 1981, when my brother Salmi and Jean Vernis were murdered. And for us in the KDP, although we knew that there was always danger in our work, I think we were very naive in terms of what the real character of the state was. And Salmi and Jean were murdered in broad daylight, downtown 2nd and Main, by a hired gang of Filipinos that were hired by the president of their union. And at the time of their murders, Salmi and Jean were not only active in the anti-Marcos movement, but had just been elected as officers to the Alaska Cannery Workers Union, an old-time union that organized cannery workers in Alaska that had had a history of communist leadership back in the 40s and 50s before the McCarthy era, a leadership that Salmi and Jean had sought out to learn from their experiences of how to reform their union. And in 1981, Salmi and Jean and the reform movement that had finally taken power of that union decided to utilize their positioning to help the workers in the Philippines fight martial law. And for that, it cost them their lives. It's been 20 years since then, but the experiences and the memories of that fight are very fresh in the peoples that took up that struggle. I can remember rooms like this filled after Salmi and Jean were murdered down at the Union Hall, down at the Cannery Workers Union Hall, in which we strategized week after week on how we were actually going to take on the forces that had colluded to murder Salmi and Jean. And because we were so well positioned in our Filipino community, if we looked back on our analysis of who the forces that colluded to kill Salmi and Jean back in 1981 to when we went to trial in 1989, we were right on the mark. It was not only the forces that wanted to take back that union in order to do dispatching of workers through monetary pay. So it was the gangsters that were in that union. It was not only the United States who wanted to keep Marcos in power in the Philippines and their intelligence forces who spied on Salmi Domingo and Jean Vernis and the anti-Marcos movement, but it was also the Marcos regime who had every interest in keeping the U.S. labor movement from supporting the Filipino workers in the United States in the Philippines. So it was those three forces that colluded to kill Salmi and Jean. And at the onset of our work, which we did under the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Vernis, people scoffed and said, "You will never be able to prove your case. You know, who were these men that you think the U.S. government and the Philippine government would come over here and murder in Seattle in a tiny union hall?" And for 7-8 years, we continued with our theory. We pressed the U.S. government to give us intelligence documents. We pursued the Marcos regime until he was dead in the ground. Well, he's not dead in the ground yet. He's still in a case in the Philippines. But we pursued every angle that we could and every person that had information on this case. And we filed and we went through 4 murder trials in which 4 people were put in jail for life imprisonment without parole. Although not one of these people ever spoke of the role that of any information they had about this case, because they were just the lower paid hitmen, and one was, as I said, was the president of the union. We continued with our case. We filed a civil suit against the U.S. government, against the intelligence agencies, the Naval Intelligence Agency, the CIA, the FBI, all of those agencies, as well as the Marcos regime. And in the end, and it wasn't easy, you know, because in the midst of that, our organizations fell apart, conditions changed, and the movement went into an ebb. After 7 years, people, you know, obviously they go back to what they were doing in their previous lives, and they have other work that they carry out. And so only a few people are left holding the work. you know, to keep putting out that newsletter once a year, to hold a memorial once a year to honor Selma and Gene, and to remember people, to remind people, what is this a case about? And it was important for us, not only in order to get justice for Selma and Gene, but also because at that period of time during the Reagan administration, the international solidarity movement here in the United States was under attack violently. U.S. foreign policy always has a domestic policy to match it. And so when the United States decided to support dictatorships abroad, they had to silence the opposition here in the United States, so that the Salvadorian movement faced deportation to a dictatorship that was under Duarte. The Chilean government, which had been overthrown, was also, there were two murders here in the United States in Washington, D.C., Letelier and Moffett murders in 1976. The Palestinians, who continued to fight for their homeland in the Middle East, were also under deportation and death threats. And the Vietnamese movement in support of the communist Vietnamese government also suffered murders and harassment by the former Vietnamese soldiers that now lived here in the United States. So those people that stepped forth to try to change U.S. foreign policy faced repression here in the United States, and Salmi and Jean's murder were part of that. And we were lucky. Well, we were lucky in some ways, but we persisted, and our movement was built. And fortunately, Marcos was overthrown in 1986, and the conditions to win our case changed also. And so in 1989, as Soya said, we won the case, the first case of any dictator being held liable for murders of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, and we won a $15 million judgment. I didn't get all that money, though. So, I still work, and I work downtown, Dustin, and I'm not a sellout. So anyway, and I just want to close by saying, when I talked to Dick Burton about what they wanted us to talk about, he said, you know, what keeps me going? And what keeps me going is knowing that the class struggle is not finished. And while it may sound rhetorical, when I wake up every day, no matter how tired I am, I have two children, I continue to work hard, you know, for those that don't have what I have. And I know that this country can provide for every single person that lives in this country. And although I could have a good life, I mean, I do have a good life, and I could sit home and I could watch TV and enjoy my two small children, you know, I choose to be engaged in the class struggle still. And if I had to say what my major turning point in my life is, you know, my friends laugh at this, but I would say, you know, the class struggle became real for me when I read the book, What is to Be Done, by Lenin. And it was the period of time in which the work I was doing, what I had learned over, you know, the years of doing political work, and when I read that book, it changed my life, and I became committed to fighting in the class struggle from then on, and I've kept going, and I do it through organizations like LILO. I brought a delegation of women to Cuba to see what socialism is like, and that's the type of work I continue on today. So thank you.
And next we have Aaron Dixon. Aaron was the founder of the Black Panther Party here in Seattle and a member of the national leadership of the Black Panther Party. He served for several years as the bodyguard to Panther leader Elaine Brown. And we are very honored to have him here speaking with us today. Mr. Aaron Dixon.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here. I asked Dustin what he wanted me to talk about, and what he said was he wanted to talk about my experiences as a member of the Black Panther Party. So I'll talk a little bit about that. What caused me to get involved in the movement was a lot of different things. And as was stated earlier, there was a lot of things going on in the 60s. There were revolutions that were occurring all over the world, and Che Guevara became a very important figure in that in a lot of the struggles that were taking place. The Vietnam War broke out, and a lot of people that I was going to school with were being sent away to go to Vietnam, and a lot of them were coming back in body bags. My father, who was one of my heroes, had a lot to do with my awareness and my political consciousness, because he talked to us all the time about some of the horrors that he saw in World War II and what happened to him as a black soldier in Mississippi. And, you know, I listened to those stories and I watched what was going on, and I became a person that was really interested in what was going on with other people. I really became concerned about what was happening in the world and what was happening with other people. We also grew up in a decade when there were six to seven political assassinations. We watched the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and Kennedy did, even though he may not have been the savior that a lot of people claim him to be, he did represent something new. He did represent a change for a lot of people and a lot of black people. So when he was assassinated, it affected the entire country. A couple of years later, Medgar Evers was assassinated. Medgar Evers was someone who was very important in the civil rights movement. He was very close with Martin Luther King and had a lot to do with the civil rights movement and a lot of the organizing that was going on in the South. And he was assassinated. In 1966, Malcolm X was assassinated. Malcolm X represented that spark. He represented that sense of revolt and that sense of purpose. And he touched a lot of lives in terms of young people in America. And so when he was assassinated, it really left a tremendous hole in the hearts of a lot of people. And then 2 years later, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And Martin Luther King represented so much hope for the people of America and also the people of the world, because he was a man of peace. And he was willing to sacrifice, he was willing to put himself out on the line and sacrifice himself so that everybody could live as decent human beings. But when Martin Luther King was assassinated, the same things that was going through my head went through the heads of thousands of other black men and women all across this country. And that was that when they killed Martin Luther King, that was the beginning of war. And it was a declaration of war when they killed Martin Luther King. We decided that if they could kill a man of peace such as Martin Luther King, then it was time for us to pick up guns, and it was time for us to organize, and it was time for us to be serious about the struggle and be serious about the movement. And that was about the time that I joined the Black Panther Party. And several months later, the Black Panther Party spread across the country like wildfire. And every city and town in this country, just about, Black Panther Party chapter began to grow. And the Black Panther Party was not about being a victim. We weren't about taking things lightly. We were about bringing it to the power structure and about telling the power structure that we were demanding change and we were going to make change by any means necessary. And so the guns became a very important part of what we were doing in those early years. And we began to look at other ways of organizing, and so we began to start survival programs, is what we call them. And we started the first free breakfast program in Oakland in 1968, and we started the first one here in 1969. And pretty soon we had the breakfast programs all across the country. And we were feeding over 5,000 kids all across the country. And we weren't getting any government funds because we had a rule in the Black Panther Party that said we could not accept any government funds from the federal government. So that means we spent a lot of our time going out and organizing and collecting donations and feeding these kids and starting a lot of other programs. And that's when we began to realize that we had the power to change whatever it was in our community. And so we began to implement a lot of other programs. We began to open up a free medical clinic. We opened up the Sidney Miller Free Medical Clinic in 69. And pretty soon the medical clinics were all across the country. And I might add that medical clinic is still open today. Then we started the Free Busing to Prisons program. Then we started the Liberation School. Then we started the Free Pest program. And we started the Free Ambulance program in New York and North Carolina. We started a whole host of other programs. And being in the Black Panther Party was very serious business because we lived, breathed, and slept the people. We woke up at 6 o'clock in the morning, and we reported to the breakfast program. And we, at 8 o'clock, we would come back to the office and clean up and eat, and we'd go out into the field and sell papers because everybody was required to sell 100 papers a day. And then we started, then people who worked in the various programs had to work in their programs and coordinate their programs, the breakfast programs, the liberation schools, and all of those other programs. And could you imagine we were doing all of this without any government funding? Here in Seattle, we had 5 breakfast program locations, and we had a medical clinic that was open 3 days a week, and we had a busing program that was taking people to prisons every weekend to the various prisons in the state, and we had a liberation school that ran during the summertime, and we did not receive any government funding whatsoever. And one of the beautiful things about the breakfast program was that the welfare mothers started coming out to the breakfast program and asking us, what can we do? And we said, well, you can help us cook the food. And in a very short period of time, the welfare mothers completely took over the breakfast program. All we had to do was get the food and bring it to the locations, and the mothers took care of the rest. And this way we found that we were empowering the community. We were showing the community that they had the ability to change whatever it is that is bothering your community, whatever it is that is bothering you. You have the ability to change that. You don't need to go out and demand. You don't need to go out and beg. You don't need to go out and cry. You have all the tools to change whatever it is that you need to change within yourself, within your community. So that was one of the most powerful things that the Black Panther Party did, was empowering people and empowering the community and showing community that they had the ability to change whatever it is that they needed to change. One of the things that came out of the breakfast program is that we forced the government to start feeding children throughout the nation. By 1972, the federal government actually initiated their own breakfast program in all of the schools. They also made money available for medical clinics in the community because we were able to expose the contradictions that here we are, the wealthiest country in America, and we can't provide medical care for everybody. We still can't provide medical care for everybody, but hopefully at some point that will happen. So there were a lot of tremendous, powerful things that happened in the Black Panther Party. Of course, there was a downside. There were a lot of people that were killed, a lot of people that were assassinated. And, you know, I remember going to so many funerals that I became very, very cold and very unfeeling, and you know, I got to the point where, you know, I would go to a funeral and see a comrade in the casket, and there just wasn't any feeling. I was just numb. So you know, a lot of us were affected tremendously by all the things that occurred in the Black Panther Party. Despite the COINTELPRO, despite the attack by the power structure that they waged on the Black Panther Party, which was probably the most vicious a campaign that this government has ever waged against an organization, we were still able to survive. We were able to survive. And it wasn't the power structure, it wasn't the government that destroyed the Black Panther Party. And this is a lesson that we learned from. It wasn't the government that destroyed the Black Panther Party. It was us, ourselves. We let the gates open so that we could be destroyed so that our organization would fall apart. And in the early years, we were engaged in warfare. We really were engaged. It really was a war. You know, I can remember, you know, everybody who was in the Black Panther Party, you had to be on security duty. You had to do guard duty. You had to go to the office. Your shift might be from 2 to 4 or 4 to 8 or from 12 to 2 or whatever, but you had to be on security at all times at any Black Panther Party facility because they were righteously trying to kill us. And what destroyed the Black Panther Party, as I said earlier, was ourselves. Is that we, because we were engaged in war in those earlier years, we did not have the opportunity to really be able to look at our own personal issues and some of the personal things that we were dealing with. And as a result, when the peacetime came after 1972 and we moved to the area of peace, and we were no longer in the stage of always being on guard and in fear of our lives, that's when things began to break down in the Black Panther Party. And I just want to emphasize that I believe that part of the struggle, part of what we have to do, also has a lot to what we have to do with ourselves and how we interact with other people and how we deal with other people. You know, we had a lot of rules in the Black Panther Party, and we had a lot of ways of dealing with things, but we had a lot of issues that always kept coming up, and there was always issues about women and about relationships and how men treat women and how women treat men and how somebody in the leadership is treated and how people in leadership are treated better than somebody in the rank and file. So we had a lot of issues that we all were constantly dealing with and constantly trying to straighten out. And at some point, a lot of those personal problems took its toll on the Black Panther Party, and it wiped out the Black Panther Party. So some of the things that I can say that we learned from that is that we do have to remember about, yeah, the struggle is physical. It's on the outside world. It's in the material world. But at the same time, oppression has created a lot of psychological problems in a lot of us. And we have to remember that. We have to remember to deal with those issues. We have to always be conscious about how we treat other people and how we treat other people that are, how men treat women and how women treat men. And we always have to be conscious about the fact that we are always looking for somebody to lead us. And we have to realize that we have the ability, we all have leadership qualities about ourselves. You know, I was just recently thinking about the lull that has happened in the past 15 years and how the crack epidemic, the toll that the crack epidemic has taken on the Black community, and the fact that during this crack epidemic there was no leadership, there was no organization to guide the Black community and the other community through this terrible problem that we were going through. But what I saw, what I've seen in the last 15 years is a lot of little small victories, a lot of little small people doing a lot of little different things. You know, people volunteering to be coaches and for little league basketball and football teams, and older adults taking in kids who were homeless, and people just spending a little extra time working with young people, and people taking it upon themselves or starting little small programs where they can have some effect on somebody next door and somebody in their community. And so basically what I'm trying to say is that we all have the ability, we all have the ability to lead and to create positive things. We don't always have to be looking for somebody to lead us to the promised land. That was one of the things that happened in the Civil Rights Movement, was that we put Martin Luther King on a pedestal, and he was our savior, he was our God, and we were looking to him for everything. And when he was assassinated, that was it. There was no more Civil Rights Movement. And that's the same thing we did with Huey Newton. Even though we talked about it, and we studied Marxist-Leninism, we talked about the cult of the personality, which happened in China and what happened in Russia. We studied it and we talked about it, and we still allowed it to happen. You know, there was something inside of us that just felt that we just had to put this man up on a pedestal and worship him like a god, and whatever he said, we would follow and we would do. And eventually, when Huey became addicted to cocaine, he took down the Black Panther Party, and the Black Panther Party was destroyed. So there's a lesson to be learned in that, is that we all have the ability to lead. We don't have to look for a savior. We don't have to look for someone to lead us to the promised land, that we have the ability to do that in ourselves. We have to think about different strategies. You know, what happened in the 60s, what was going on in the 60s, and the way that we organized in the 60s, it's different now. We live in a different time period now. And I was reading something, an article that someone had written about David Horowitz. And David Horowitz is somebody who used to be a radical. He did some work with the party, and he did a lot of radical work. And he switched over. Now he's a Republican. Now he's a staunch Republican. But what he said was that the left always likes to feel like a victim. And that is so very true. And I have found that to be true in the struggle. And I could say that the Black Panther Party stood away from that a little bit. And that was what made the Black Panther Party so powerful, is that we did not look upon ourselves as victims. But overall, I think the left does have a tendency to look at themselves as victims, and look at themselves and look at the power structure as this big, giant, powerful monster that is just going to wipe out everybody and wipe out everything, you know. A lot of people are always coming to me about some conspiracy theory that they've heard, and you know, there's a big conspiracy for this, and there's a big conspiracy for that. And, you know, a lot of that stuff may be true, but I don't pay any attention to that, because by paying attention to that type of stuff, you're giving them more credit and more power than what they really have, you know. And we always say that the people make the power. The people have the power. There are more of us than there are of them, you know. And we got the power. The only problem is that our consciousness is all screwed up. Our consciousness is all fucked up. We got to get our consciousness right. We have to be able to influence other people. We have to feel like that we have power. We can't feel like we're victims. We have to feel like we got the power. We can tell these fools what to do. We can tell these fools where to go. We just have to realize how to do it. We just have to come together and realize that we can do it. So if I would depart anything to you is that you must realize that you do have power. You got power. I mean, just look at what happened at the WTO, you know, and that was the power of the people right there. That was the power of the people. So, you know, a lot of the young people here, 30 years ago, there were tens of thousands of young people that were marching on universities and marching on the Capitol and hundreds of thousands of people. But where are the majority of those people now? A lot of those people have nice, cushy, soft jobs. They've retired. They've forgotten all about the movement. They don't even want to remember the movement. So you got to think about that. You got to think that, you know, what are you going to be doing 20, 30 years from now? Are you going to put yourself in a position where you are going to go from one extreme, then you're going to go to the next extreme? So you have to learn how to balance that out. You got to realize that, yes, you have to have, you're going to have a family. You got to have some way of supporting yourself and supporting your family. But at the same time, how can you balance that out? How can you move towards what you want to do individually and be successful, and also at the same time keep your consciousness and keep your political consciousness? And that's what keeps me going, is that this is the most corrupt, this is the most sick, demonic system, culture that has ever existed in the world. And that if we don't do something, if we don't do something to struggle against this system, if we don't do something to try to bring about some changes, there is no future for our children. There is no future for our grandchildren. That we have to balance our consciousness with other things that we want to do. And we have to feel something for other human beings. We have to feel something for all living things on this earth. And so I would say that you should keep the faith, and you should find your power, find your strength, and we can all move forward to a certain victory. Thank you.